From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 15, 2009. Israeli ground forces continue to pound into Gaza City, forcing hundreds of civilians to flee. Obama's cabinet pick for Attorney General denounces torture. And we'll go to Pakistan's tribal regions to hear about the practice of so-called honor killings. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Roland Burris officially becomes a U.S. senator today. The Illinois Democrat takes over Barack Obama's abandoned Senate seat. Controversy has surrounded Burris's appointment to Congress because the appointment came from embattled Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who is being impeached for trying to sell the seat to the highest bidder. But Democratic leaders have cleared the way for Burris to take office. Burris will now be a factor in President-elect Barack Obama's bid for Congress to release TARP funds. Obama and President Bush have both been lobbying hard for access to the final $350 billion of the bailout. Many Republican senators want to block the funds, saying the first half was mismanaged. Those senators want to pass a resolution disapproving of the release of funds. Obama says he would veto that resolution when he takes office. President Bush is scheduled to give his final televised address to the American people this evening. In other news from D.C., Obama spokesperson Robert Gibbs announced the incoming administration intends to end the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy governing gays and lesbians serving in the U.S. military. But Gibbs said the administration would not be able to work on the policy change in the beginning because of the pressing economic crisis, but he said the president-elect is, quote, committed to following through. The U.S. recession is hitting the Mexican economy hard and has dragged the value of the peso down to a 15-year low against the U.S. dollar. Shannon Young has the details.
An old saying sums up Mexico's economic reality. When the U.S. sneezes, Mexico catches a cold. Yesterday saw the largest nosedive in the value of the Mexican peso against the U.S. dollar since the country's massive financial meltdown of the mid-1990s. As of midday, the Mexican peso was selling for even less than it was when it hit its 15-year low mark against the dollar on Wednesday. Economists blame the U.S. recession, noting that just over 80% of Mexican exports go to U.S. markets, where retail sales are down. The peso had enjoyed years of relative stability against the dollar, but the currency has lost about one-third of its value since October, providing a strong incentive for Mexican nationals to migrate in search of jobs that pay in U.S. dollars. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
FSRN continues to follow the controversial expansion of London's Heathrow Airport. The British government has defied environmentalists and given the go-ahead for a third runway. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Heathrow is already one of the world's busiest airports, and environmentalists say adding another runway is tantamount to building a new airport. Member of Parliament John McDonnell was suspended from Parliament today after this angry outburst when he learned the government wouldn't allow a vote on the matter.
However difficult they are.
We represent
order, 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 order. The honourable member must withdraw. Order.
I was hoping that the government would allow us a democratic debate and a vote. And to deny that, I think, undermines our parliamentary democracy. There are people in all political parties in the House of Commons who are very angry about this decision because it will undermine our climate change policies as well as impact upon the lives of up to 2 million Londoners with increased noise and pollution.
So much so that it's believed the airport expansion violates European Union pollution laws. The expansion will also require the destruction of an entire village, including 700 homes and a 500-year-old pub. A legal challenge is expected within days. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
In protest of Israel's continuing attacks on Gaza, Bolivian President Evo Morales ended diplomatic relations with the Middle Eastern country. Lenny Oliveira reports from Cochabamba.
In addition to announcing a rupture in diplomatic ties, yesterday Morales also demanded the Israeli Prime Minister be charged with genocide in international court. The private business community in Bolivia expressed concern over Morales' announcement. They say the decision will hurt commercial interests in the country, but the government says that shouldn't happen because diplomatic relationships do not necessarily affect commercial activities among private companies. The Palestinian community in Bolivia celebrated the decision. Over the past weeks, they joined other human rights groups in rallies and protests in major Bolivian cities, calling for an end to Israel's military actions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Oliveira from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. A group of doctors, journalists, lawmakers, and human rights workers aboard a ship packed with medicine destined for the Gaza Strip says that the Israeli Navy threatened to kill them as they sailed into international waters some 100 miles from the coast of Gaza. A similar attempt to deliver aid by the Free Gaza Movement was thwarted by Israel's Navy about 2 weeks ago when gunboats smashed into and nearly sank a ship carrying supplies and unarmed civilians. For the second time in less than 1 month, a ship is being forced to turn back before much-needed aid reaches Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli ground forces are continuing their incursion into populated areas in Gaza City, striking a hospital and a United Nations Relief Agency warehouse and causing hundreds of frenzied civilians to flee. As the death toll in Gaza nears 1,100, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says the growing number of casualties has reached an unbearable point. FSRN's Rami Almagari has the story from Gaza.
According to Palestinian medics, Israeli military escalation against Gaza claimed the lives of more than 25 Palestinians Thursday, including women and children. Dozens of others were injured. One of the Israeli airstrikes in Gaza City hit the house of the brother of Hamas's interior minister, Saeed Siam, leaving a number of casualties. Hamas confirmed the death of Saeed Siam late Thursday. For the first time in 20 days, Israeli troops also invaded a populated Gaza City neighborhood, shelling a hospital and an UNRWA headquarters. Mohammed al-Haddad is a Gaza resident. The Israeli tanks were deployed near his house in the Tal al-Hawa neighborhood.
By the tower where I live, there were two tanks. Just a few minutes ago, we heard shooting and the screams of a dying person. And suddenly we heard no screaming. They opened fire at any moving object.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has been trying to negotiate a ceasefire. Speaking in Israel, he described the death toll as a result of ongoing Israeli attacks on Gaza as unbearable, saying that reaching a ceasefire depends on Israel. Sami Mushasha is a spokesperson of the UNRWA, who spoke to FSRN following the latest Israeli bombings Thursday.
In the past 48 hours, the Israeli army has targeted 6 to 7 UNRWA posts. The latest was today. The place that was hit is the UNRWA's headquarters, which warehouses flour, fuel tankers, and 750 civilians are also staying there. It seems there is no safe place, either for the UNRWA or their beneficiaries.
Amid such developments, the Israeli cabinet is considering an Egyptian-proposed temporary ceasefire, to which Hamas has agreed principally. Since December 27, the death toll in Gaza has risen to nearly 1,100. Nearly half are women, children, and elderly. The total injuries are approximately 5,000, including hundreds critically. Nearly a dozen Palestinian homemade rockets were launched into nearby Israeli towns. The Israeli death toll is 7 civilians and a dozen soldiers, 2 of them killed by friendly fire. Dozens of Israelis have been injured. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almagari in Gaza.
Violence continues in Pakistan's tribal areas in a variety of forms. In addition to attacks from U.S. drones, the Pakistani military and militants, there's a centuries-old tradition that continues to harm women. A practice called honor killing convicts women with murder if they're deemed to have brought shame to the family.
Aphrodite Afridi has the story of an 18-year-old named Bakht Zamina who was shot dead by her brother.
Young women fetch water from a public tank in this village called Jamrod, 15 miles from Peshawar city. Women from the neighboring villages flock this reservoir, carrying big pots full of drinking water, and children accompany them playing soccer and cricket all the way. Until last month, 18-year-old Bakht Zamina was part of this group, fetching water from this tank every day. I found it extremely hard to convince women in this group to speak to me about their friend Zamina, who was killed only a few weeks ago. Zamina is the victim of a practice called honor killing. Finally, I found a man from the same village, Jafar Khan, agreeing to speak on mic.
Bakht Zamina was around 18 years old when her family killed her. She became pregnant from another man a few months before her marriage, but she was still married off to another man. Some months after her marriage, she gave birth to a baby girl. After the child's birth, Zamina's in-laws sent her back to her parents' home, complaining that the baby was born outside the marriage. To save the family's honor, her brother killed the infant baby girl by stoning her to death. And later, in the tradition of honor killing, Bakht's brother shot her dead in front of the whole village.
I tried to speak with someone from Zamina's family. It's a matter of big shame and disgrace for her family if they talked about Zamina. Let bygone is be bygone here. However, her cousin Wajid Shah agreed to speak to me. Wajid Shah was standing beside Zamina's brother when she was shot dead. Her elder brother fired 5 bullets on Zamina's chest and head.
All of our family members assembled in the house, and her father refused to shoot her. Her elder brother came forward and shot her dead. I have no regrets. I do not feel bad at all. It's our culture and tradition. Such women should be killed in this way because they do not think of our family honor.
Zamina's family could not find her lover, who is the biological father of her baby. Traditionally, the fate of that man also would be death. Again, Wajid Shah.
We did not find the accused person because he left the country. Therefore, we killed his uncle instead.
Malak Lukman is a popular leader in the tribal area. He is a big supporter of honor killings.
It is women who initiate and invite men for sex. Men cannot do anything unless a woman agrees. Therefore, we kill women. It is a good tradition, and I do not think anybody can stop this, and it should not be stopped.
The women are helpless to change this barbaric custom. There are very few women who would escape and elope from rigid societies like this one. In the past, a local woman NGO called Aurat Foundation ran a shelter home, but the government closed it down, calling it a security threat. As a ray of hope, now the Northwest Frontier Province has its first woman minister looking after the portfolio of women development. Sitara Ayaz is committed to change practices like honor killings.
Everybody knows that we have a militancy here and the law and order situation is not good. But in the past, if we talk about like few months back, the number of honor killing was decreased. But due to this this law and order situation, again it's increased. But we are trying our level best to decrease this number again.
Aurat Foundation surveys reports that more than 600 women die of honor killings every year. But this number is a gross underestimate, since most cases of honor killings go unreported. From Jamrud village closer to Pak-Afghan border, this is Afridi Afridi for FSRN.
One of Guantanamo Bay's youngest prisoners has been ordered released by D.C.'s U.S. District Court. 21-year-old Mohammed Al-Gharani, who is also known as Yusuf Al-Gharani, was picked up in Pakistan under suspicion of having ties with Al-Qaeda. He was just 14 years old when he arrived at Guantanamo in 2002. Judge Richard Leon ruled that the Bush administration has failed to prove that Guarani is an enemy combatant and that the young man must be released and sent home, which may prove to be an obstacle. Guarani is a citizen of Chad, and it is unclear whether the country will allow him to return. One person who experienced Guantanamo firsthand is James Yee. He's a former U.S. Army chaplain who served at Gitmo. After denouncing what he witnessed at the detention camp, he was accused of espionage. The Muslim chaplain was blindfolded, cuffed, and held in solitary confinement for nearly 3 months before he was released without charges. He explains some of what he witnessed at Gitmo.
Well, there were times when, for example, prisoners were forcefully having their beards shaved. Of course, wearing a beard for very conservative practicing Muslims is a sign of religious piety. The Qurans were desecrated at various times during my time at Guantanamo, not only by guards, but also by interrogators. The guards made an issue when they searched the cells of searching Qurans and throwing them on the ground and whatnot. And this, of course, really infuriated the prisoner population. But things got much, much worse when interrogators actually began to do this in the interrogation rooms by throwing the Qurans on the ground in front of prisoners, stamping on it, kicking it, sitting on it. And now if you even look into the official reports, investigations into abuses of the Quran at Guantanamo, you find incidences in where the Quran was actually urinated on by U.S. personnel. So this is surely a desecration of what's considered to be the literal words of God by over 1.3 billion Muslims around the world. People were persecuted for their belief in God, as sometimes individuals were taken to interrogation and interrogators attempted to force them to perform their prayers in what appeared to be a satanic circle, you know, indicated or marked in an interrogation room. There was sexual humiliation by female interrogators who attempted to exploit the conservative Muslim etiquette of establishing modesty between men and women, and where you find in many Muslim cultures that separation. So female interrogators would rub themselves on shackled prisoners. These female interrogators themselves strip themselves naked in order to, in the process of conducting these types of investigations. There were incidences where female interrogators would give these prisoners what you might say a free lap dance, as they could not resist in their shackled positions. And now also, again, and I point to official military investigations into abuses of prisoners in Guantanamo, they suggest that female interrogators even grab the genitals of Muslim male prisoners while interrogating them. So all of these things dealt with religion being used as a point to try and humiliate and degrade the prisoners at Guantanamo.
James Yee, you are currently on a speaking tour and you're scheduled to speak next week after the inauguration. What do you plan to talk about and what message are you trying to give to the Obama administration?
I will continue to raise awareness about, you know, what has happened and what has gone on in Guantanamo, what's the legal black hole that it has essentially become, the human rights abuses that have occurred there. And as a national delegate for Barack Obama at the 2008 Democratic National Convention, I'm someone who is trying to hold the president-elect to his promises. He campaigned on promising to close Guantanamo, of banning torture without exception, adhering to the Geneva Conventions, and restoring habeas rights to prisoners. So I think he needs to come through on these promises. And, you know, I'm joined with many others who want the new president to follow through on his word.
James Yee, thank you for taking some time to speak with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
James Yee is a former U.S. Army chaplain who served at Guantanamo Bay before being accused of spying. He was detained but eventually released without charges. President-elect Obama is expected to issue an order to close Gitmo as early as his first day in office, although he says that actually closing down the detention facility may take months. During his Senate confirmation hearing today, Obama's nominee for Attorney General Eric Holder said that some prisoners will be released and others will be prosecuted, but that another group cannot be prosecuted and are still considered dangerous. Holder also indicated significant reversals from the previous attorney general under the Bush administration. Holder made it clear that waterboarding is torture. Eric Holder also said that the United States will comply with standards of humane treatment outlined in international law. That's another reversal from current U.S. policy. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The grand hearing room for Eric Holder's confirmation hearing was filled with senators, press, Holder's supporters, and activists wearing orange jumpsuits to represent detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Chair of the Judiciary Committee Patrick Leahy offered a stern warning.
Lately, there seem to be a number of demonstrations and hearings. I just want everybody to understand the ground rules. If people stand up and block the view of those behind them, I would direct the officers to remove the people who are blocking the view.
The activists liked what they heard when Eric Holder denounced the interrogation tactic, waterboarding.
I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. Waterboarding is torture.
Chair Leahy pressed on the president's authority to approve torture.
Do you believe that the president of the United States has authority to exercise a commander-in-chief override and immunize acts of torture? I ask that because we did not get a satisfactory answer from former Attorney General Gonzalez on that.
Mr. Chairman, no one is above the law.
The current Department of Justice has refused to classify waterboarding as torture. It has also expanded the scope of presidential power, citing a time of war as a means to dismiss international and domestic law.
Yes, Senator, Guantanamo will be closed.
Holder says closing the detention center in Cuba could take time. He suggests using the U.S. court system to try some detainees, something the current administration has opposed.
I think substantial numbers of those people can be sent to other countries safely. Other people can be tried in a jurisdiction and put in jail. And there are possibly going to be other people who we're not going to be able to try for a variety of reasons, but who nevertheless are dangerous to this country. And we're going to have to try to figure out what we do with them.
As for the controversial surveillance program, Holder in the past has been an outspoken opponent. He said the current law, which legalized many of the administration's surveillance tactics, was appropriate and would be renewed. But he left some opening by saying he would undertake extensive review of it.
What I'd like to do is examine how those provisions have worked, talk to people, investigators and lawyers, and get a sense of what it is they think has worked well with regard to those provisions, what perhaps needs to be changed.
Although he didn't go so far to promise a criminal investigation of the Bush administration's Justice Department, he did say he would begin a review and make the findings available to Congress. If confirmed, Holder would be the first African-American attorney general. He noted the significance of his testimony on what would be Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 80th birthday. He promised to prioritize restoring the Civil Rights Division, which has been plagued by low morale and scandal under the Bush administration. He's received endorsements from civil rights groups to law enforcement. But some Republicans appear defiant. Top Republican of the committee, Arlen Specter, quizzed Holder about his pardon of fugitive tax evader Mark Rich, a pardon he approved when he served as acting attorney general under President Clinton. Holder has called that pardon a mistake.
Given the background of this man, it's hard to brush it off, it seems to me, as a mistake.
The Judiciary Committee and then the full Senate must vote on his confirmation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate Committee on Homeland Security held its confirmation hearing for Obama's pick to head that department, current Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano. Committee members questioned Napolitano on border control, FEMA, Real ID, and even pat-downs at airport security checkpoints. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
In selling herself for the top spot at Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano touted her experience as a governor of a border state, working with Homeland Security's FEMA department during Arizona's forest fires and Hurricane Katrina. She also cited her state's effort to fight terrorism by centralizing intelligence. But what senators really wanted to talk about was border control. Senator Joseph Lieberman is the chair of the Senate's Homeland Security Committee.
What are your thoughts about how better to secure our border and enforce our immigration laws? We've struggled with this. We've acted on it. We've spent a lot of money so far. Do you think we should attempt to cover the entire southern border with a fence?
Napolitano said her strategy would be to increase boots on the ground and to rev up technology at the border.
These borders are vast, and manpower alone is not going to do it. You need to be able to augment manpower with technology and keep pushing that technology fence, as it were. There is a role for some fencing, particularly around urban areas, because it helps prevent those who are crossing illegally from blending immediately into a town population.
Napolitano said she would not advise to expand the fence any more than that. The committee then went on to the prosecution of companies who hire undocumented workers. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill.
I would like to hear your plans for prioritizing the enforcement of our immigration laws against those who allow 40 or 50 people to use the same Social Security number in the workplace.
Napolitano said she had signed the toughest employment sanction bill in the country for the state of Arizona. She also said it can't only be her department working on the problem.
We have to have appropriate agreements with the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's offices that they're going to bring actual cases.
But some say despite the tough immigration rhetoric, Napolitano knows that current policies aren't working. Michelle Watson is the senior policy analyst for the Immigration Policy Center.
Of course, she understands that we need to comply with the law, but I think she also understands that the current laws are broken and that we do need to reform the system and that targeting workers, targeting immigrant families is probably not the way to go about fixing our immigration system.
Napolitano was also questioned on Real ID national identification cards. Immigrants' rights groups have come out against the cards, along with digital privacy organizations and civil libertarians. But Napolitano didn't cite those problems.
I did sign a bill. I was one of a number of states that said we would not participate in Real ID, not out of a philosophical objection to the goal of having a secure driver's license that could be relied upon in our country, but because it's a huge fiscal burden on it costs a lot of money to do it.
Napolitano said there should be more review of states on the use of Real ID cards. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Today is the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. To celebrate this day, which will be officially observed with the federal holiday Monday, FSRN will close today with his words delivered at a sermon at Riverside Church on April 4, 1967.
And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. If you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power. And I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name.
Martin Luther King Jr. would have turned 80 years old today. And that will do it for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.